Hey, Matt, I've got a joke for you.
Oh, you've got a joke? Let's hear it. Fire away.
What's the difference between Godzilla and Evangelion?
Okay, I know this one. It's Ava's got bits of Christian symbolism. No, they both got that. Godzilla gets randomly horny in ways that make Sam uncomfortable. No, they both got that too. Godzilla has at least one handsome dude for Joanna to gush. No, that's. I'm lost. You got me.
One's about how pathetic you are in comparison to giant monsters, and the other one's just about how pathetic you are, period. Yes, don't get that one. Well, maybe you will by the end of the show. Hello, I'm Ryan of the Godzilla Evangelists, and I couldn't even say the word anime without my pal Matt sniffing around. So he's here to help us attempt to navigate the world of Evangelion.
Yeah, I heard how you got that other black guy who likes anime to do the Godzilla anime movies, and I'm not happy about that. I'm the original. I'm the core of the Geek Stew dummy plug system. You can't replace me.
I'm sorry. I should have known better. Man, maybe we'll have both you and Greg on for Godzilla's singular point.
That would
That'd be
be
wild.
the only thing that could make that wilder is if one of us loves it and one of us hates it.
Exactly. That's what I'm hoping for. But today, we're going to talk about Evangelion first and then start tying it into Godzilla. So if you're only interested in the Godzilla-related stuff, I'm about to give you a timestamp to skip to. But we urge you to listen to the whole show because I did not think I would be an Evangelion fan, but it's really interesting and not what I expected in a good way. So I say give it a shot. We're going to go through some really fun and interesting stuff. But if you want it, here's the timestamp, which you should also use if you are really scared of spoilers, specifically Evangelion spoilers. And that time is about 38 minutes and 45 seconds.
And as the person who bared witness to this process, folks, it was hilarious to watch him slog through the first four episodes with me and then just burn through it all behind my back when I wasn't looking.
That could be you too. But yeah, let's dive right into it. Part one, non-spoilery Evangelion discussion. So we're gonna start off with mostly non-spoilery stuff, but if you really want to know nothing about Eva going in, be warned. But really, this is the kind of stuff you're gonna learn throughout the first episode or two anyway. So it's really not much. And I've watched the Platinum Director's Cuts version of the original 26 episodes and the dubbed end of Evangelion movie. So that's what we're working off of. I know there's like lots of little differences in different versions, right,
Oh, don't even get me started.
Matt?
We're so there's multiple dubs. There's multiple scripts and versions of episodes with little differences and ticks to them. We're just gonna stick with what I know and what I grew up with. So if you've seen the Netflix version, if you've seen the Japanese version, take it with a grain of salt.
I know we're probably not watching the quote most right version, but this is what we're doing.
That's debatable, but let's not get into
Don't tell the people on the Ava Geeks Wiki though.
Oh, if you think this is the only hot take opinion I'm gonna have today, you're gonna have a bad time. Let's hear it, fire
So
away.
for the few people who don't really know what the show's about, I would say the people under a rock, but I feel like even if you know vaguely about Ava, you might have the wrong idea of what it really is. So, Matt, why don't you talk about the gist of the show and the central characters?
So, Eva is a, I believe, early 90s anime that went on to become a very big deal. The gist of the show is you've got this 14-year-old boy named Shinji, and out of the blue, his estranged dad says, "Hey, I want you to come and pilot my giant robot to fight aliens. Which is all well and good, except Shinji has problems. Daddy issues chief among them. But regardless, he is roped into a battle with these eldritch, horrifying creatures called angels that only this giant robot, the Evangelion, can fight. And the bulk of the show is him fighting these creatures as they show up, making new allies, meeting new people, before everything completely goes to hell.
That's it in a nutshell. But let's talk a little bit more about the characters. So of course we have Shinji, who, depending on who you are, could be eminently relatable or hateable or both.
It is, all options are possible, more than you know.
Yeah, he's infamously a very whiny guy, right? But as the show goes on, you start to get the idea of like, okay, I can kind of understand why.
To put it in perspective, he's an anti-hero, not in the like grizzled Punisher Wolverine tough guy type, but in sorely lacking in the qualities that make someone a hero. He is not usually brave. He is not usually, you know, optimistic and forthcoming.
Right. There are parts of this story where you're not sure whether he's going to be a Superman or a school shooter, so to speak.
Ooh, that's a that hit, that one's, ooh, yeah, we'll save that for the spoiler discussion.
And then of course there's the man behind all these problems, Gendo, his dad,
winner of the worst father in anime history by a large country mile.
and almost proud of it, really.
Yeah, Gendo's not great. I can't say much else without getting into spoilers, but
right.
He, next to the angels, I'd argue he's maybe the closest thing the show has to an antagonist.
I would agree with that. And then sort of the playing the role of the good parents. We'll put that in quotes a little bit, but not
debatable.
It's so hard to avoid spoilers. But anyway, the quote-unquote good parent, Misato, who works for the nerve agency and sort of brings Shinji into this world.
Yeah, she acts as kind of the kind of bridge commander. If you're a fan of Star Trek, I think it's Riker. She's kind of the Riker to Nerve, which is the organization that Shinji fights for, and is kind of second in command and the kind of main figurehead. She's a fun character because she's a mix between, like, this very sloppy, messy, you know, 30-year-old, I wouldn't say spinster, but unmarried, not necessarily wifey material to some people.
Right, spinster for the Japanese society of the 1990s.
Yeah. But she can flip on a dime and go to a very professional, very talented, you know, leader and commander. So, and she has a very interesting relationship with Shinji, as she seems to be the one person who is the most trying to help him and trying to bring him out of his shell.
Right. She really seems to care, and at least for me, she was one of the few likable from the start characters, which is one of the more difficult things to get into the show, is there's a lot of characters you just have trouble liking when you first meet them, or maybe you like them at first, but one or two episodes in, you learn something that makes you hate them. And so Misato is like one of the bright spots you can hang on to for a while, at least for me.
Yes, and speaking of characters who may have traits you find unlikable, I think the last two we probably want to cover, at least in terms of just, like, who's critical, are Asuka and Rei. A.K.A. the Betty and Veronica of anime for, like, the last 20 years.
Very true. This is a very loaded statement, as we'll get into. but you're either a Ray type of person or an Asuka type of person.
Or you're a grown ass adult and you're a Masato person. But again. Yeah, right.
They're both younger than 16. Yuck. But they're the Fire Queen and the Ice Queen in Shinji's life, and they both, in theory, should have a close relationship with him, but they're just these seemingly impenetrable barriers that keep them from actually becoming friends. And so there's sort of a weird back and forth as the episodes go on, where sometimes they might be a little closer and sometimes they might be a little further apart, but always this stubborn unwillingness to be honest with each other.
Yeah. And something I would definitely like call out about the two of them is that they are, for the time period and kind of in the aftermath of Eva, very archetypal characters. So when you watch Eva without any context, you might go, oh, like, I've seen the, like, you know, Asuka's the very tsundere, I don't like you, idiot, but I totally like you character. Rei seems like an emotionless doll. What made Eva kind of special is when you get into later episodes and the movie and start to peel away some of those layers and get into, like, who they really are as people, or the ways in which they are not necessarily people. And understanding that these two are the inspiration for a lot of characters you see in anime going forward. So in the same way that, like, Han Solo and Luke Skywalker, out of context, seem like these guys are so generic and boring, why aren't they important? Asuka and Rei are both very important for what they inspire going forward.
Yeah, definitely more than the other characters, it's these two, where it's not until really the last third of the episodes where you really start to understand them and feel bad or sad or worried for them. Because, minor spoiler alert, by the time you hit the last third of the episodes, nothing's going right for anyone.
Everybody in this show gets it so bad. They get it so, 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 so bad.
Oh, yeah. And, sort of kind of speaking of which, do you want to talk about, like, just one thing we love about the show, which might be a little different for both of us, and one thing we hate, which I'm pretty sure is the same thing?
Oh, there's so many things to love, but I'll try do my best to try to pick one. But since you're kind of the newbie to this, how about you go first?
Sure. Yeah, and there are more than one thing. I'm not sure what the grammar of that sentence is. There is more than one thing to love about Eva, for sure. But I guess what really grabbed me and helped me open up to some of the other things is that you find out this is not a show about giant robots. You used that phrase earlier, but that's sort of a simplification.
Yes, so that was things, a bit.
Yes. These things that look like giant robots are actually other giant monsters, very horrible ones, in shiny armor, like knights that go to sleep until you plug them into the wall. And while the difference is minimal early on, it really has an effect later. So this is not your typical squeaky clean shonen, you know, bloodless good guys and bad guys, black and white. It is grotesque and gritty in the best ways, and I love how it offers this horrifying slant on giant monster battles that you don't see so much in the Godzilla series, or really anything in the mainstream I can think of. This is I'm giving myself embarrassment by saying this, but this is a really hardcore type of series.
Yeah, there I agree with you 100%. There are fights from the Eva series and from the movie End of Evangelion that just live rent-free in my brain, because they're so brutal, but they're so well-made and well-manufactured, where it's like, this is not just, you know, oh, I swung my samurai sword and someone got their head chopped off. It's very almost primal and very animalistic the way the fights are set up and handled.
Yeah, I think something that unites 75 plus percent of the listeners of the show is that they love giant monster fights. And there are some great ones in this. And they actually play into the plot, and the plot plays into them, which is what you want out of a giant monster fight.
I'd say for me, my one of my favorite things. There's a lot of things I love about Ava. I could, spoiler warning. Ryan had to do his best to keep me from ranting for 2 hours about this behind the scenes. But one of the things I love about Ava is that the character work in Ava, even though it's very simple, is very effective and very clear. So even when the dub is not at its strongest, or there's, weird reads of lines, you by the end of the series, you understand these characters, you understand what's going on in their heads, you understand why they do the things they do and why they make the choices they make. Ono, the creator of the show, has a tendency to use a lot of psychobabble, but I think if you file that away, like, by the end of the show, you get Misato and why Misato does what she does. You get Shinji and why he makes the choices he makes. And I can think of a lot of anime that take that sort of thing a little too much for granted, or character motivations become very muddled, or their backstories are not as affectingly told as they are here. Like, I could tell you Asuka's backstory, and it's pretty cliche and straightforward, but the way it is expressed in Evangelion is like one of the things that I think made it such a smash success over a lot of shows that I think would handle the same material but worse.
Right. This is really one of those things where the devil is in the details, because on the surface, it kind of feels like a lot of anime at first. But as you get into it, it's not one of those things that's like a historical curiosity. Like, oh, this is fine, and I see why it was important. That once you finally see the whole thing, you should have an appreciation of it because it will take you on a journey.
Yeah, you get why so many fans and so many creators are still obsessed with this.
But yeah, it's still a huge deal, and I think rightly so. But there's one big boondoggle, which is that there is a lot of sexualized pervy material with the lead characters, and they're all like 14, 15, 16, and they're treated as like nearly equivalent to adults. And it goes without saying, that's super gross. And honestly, that might not make it a show for you, which is why I feel like we have to warn you. And there's no judgment from me at all. If that would turn you off, makes complete sense. And that's the biggest bummer of it, is that this otherwise really fascinating show has such a big problematic element.
Yeah, and I'll, as someone deeper into anime fandom, I'll elaborate. There are a number of different things that are kind of problematic about Ava, given, again, it was made 25 years ago, different time, different place, different culture. But I agree 100% that, like, the immediate red flag that hits me on rewatch is that you have this oogling and drooling over either underage characters or some very inappropriate relations between adults and underage characters that are not like called out explicitly as a bad. And for me, my frustration with it is, again, the show has some other issues as well, but for a show that at its best really dives into some murky and like intentionally murky, intentionally messy and complicated issues and subjects and moments where it's like characters are flawed and characters are not good people and do not always do things. And so for all the, psychosexual drama that happens with that, I feel like all of that gets kneecapped by, woo, here's a shot of Asuka's panties. Woo, thermal expansion. It constantly, again, to me, it's very distracting, and it constantly takes away from, like, moments that are more serious or moments that do need a little bit more discretion. And another piece that I would add to that that makes it worse is a lot of shows are inspired by Ava, and so they take that aspect forward without taking some of the good parts. So I can think of several shows where it's like, we'll take the horny parts of Ava and the aesthetic of Ava, but not any of the maturity or the thoughtfulness or any of the other stuff. And that, you know, years later with the remakes and the rebuilds and all that, that 20 plus years later, Anno is still going to the horny well. And it's just like, dude, you're better than this. We know you're better than this. Please stop.
Yeah, because that's the common defense, right? And you got into that a little bit, mm-hmm. that, like, oh, it's supposed to, like, point the mirror back at you and make you realize that it was gross. And, like, it's, like, from a teenager's perspective. And to some extent, that could be valid if it was a complete thought and he carried through on it. But I think that, you know, by virtue of not carrying through on it into the reboots, I think it's really more of a half-assed attempt to face it than anything else.
Yeah, sometimes Anno and the Ava crew are very thoughtful about interrogating the shitty parts of themselves and interrogating their own misogyny issues, whatever. But there are plenty of times where they are, like, unabashedly just reveling in it. Well, reveling's a harsh word, but they're not, like, fighting against it.
There's a scene in the series where the character Kaji, who's an adult, turns down Asuka. And I think you're supposed to take that as a heroic, well-intentioned moment, but it's kind of hollow because he's been flirting with her and, like, low-key perving on her for, like, many episodes before that. And so that kind of gives you a clue of, like, how they were missing the forest for the trees there.
Yeah, or, again, that undercutting where it's, like, it's hard to believe, because I think that's a director's cut episode as well, where it's, like, it's hard to believe that, like, oh, in this moment, Kaji is mature and responsible enough to be like, you are a child, I am not interested, when in his first appearance he, like, blatantly hits on Shinji, who is a 14-year-old boy. So it's like, again, not saying, you know, Kaji's a pedophile, but it's just that, like, it's not very tactful about how it handles its kind of sexual content and who it's aimed at and who it's for.
Absolutely. So when you dive into this, keep that in mind and be ready to face up to the problematic elements, or say, you know what, not for me, and skip it, and that's fine too.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that about covers everything I wanted to get into as far as the light non-spoilery stuff. So shall we dive deep into the mess that is Ava philosophy?
I will slip into my magma diver suit and we will hop right in.
Part 2, spoilery Evangelion deep dive philosophical shits. As most people know, I feel like this is fairly well known even from an outside perspective. Ava ends up getting pretty philosophical and really digging into the character's psyche. And there are always a bunch of nerds on the internet arguing about what it has to say on the human experience, loneliness, family, sexuality, belief. And we're going to join them. We're going to be one of those.
Oh, no. I fought this off for, God, 14 years.
It's no longer can you delay it. Today, we're going to talk about where Evangelion eventually goes. And our read on the subtext and what we think about it. Obviously, this is not a full-length essay, which it could be. It could be a full book. This is more a taste of what we think of the deeper, spoilery stuff. But, you know, a little deeper than we were just going into it.
All right, let's do it. Fire away.
So I think one of, like, the central themes of the show, one of the least debatable, most obvious ones, is what they call the hedgehog's dilemma, which is that they can't get close to others without exposing their vulnerability, because, you know, they're covered in pokey parts, they're covered in spines. And the same thing applies metaphorically to our main characters, where because of the spines they're putting out in one way or another, they can't get close to each other either. So with Shinji, it's because he's too frightened of what other people might do to him. In the case of Asuka, she panics and lashes out and preemptively is cruel to people. And ultimately, Anno comes around to saying this is the most important part of being human, connecting with them and growing closer and better together and finding ways to love people despite the fact that it hurts. And I agree. I thought that was a really cool core to this series.
Yeah, there are a lot of different kind of themes and ideas that Ava throws around, but I think the hedgehog's dilemma is the most consistent through line. It's brought up at the, right. It's explicitly called out and brought up at the beginning. Depending on how you read both the ending of the show and the ending of the movie, it comes back up again. But personally, I agree 100%. I think, again, buried in some psychobabble, but it strikes a chord with the heart of the show. You know, Shinji's whole arc is he's looking for love and acceptance, but at times he lacks the courage to act on it, or he's afraid of what will happen when he gets it. You know, there's a brief period in the show where it seems like he's starting to get better, he's starting to grow, he's starting to act more like a Gundam protagonist or a typical super robot protagonist. And then he gets betrayed, and he gets betrayed multiple times. And a lot of the end of the show is him trying to come to peace, acceptance. I couldn't tell you quite the word, but trying to work out, you know, how do I live in a world where I want to be loved, but I'm scared that others will hurt me, and I'm and I at the same time will hurt others myself. And again, that's that kind of having something that succinct and kind of that meaningful is really what I think kind of elevates Ava over a lot of shows where it's like, yes, by the end of the show, you have seen people hurt others and get hurt. And if you've been an adult and had a lot of adult experience, you will be in situations where like you want love, but people hurt you. And you come to realize that you hurt other people. And
yeah.
Ending nitpicks aside, I feel like Ava does a good job of really, like, milking as much as it can out of that theme.
Absolutely. And I think it's a really universal experience, right? Everybody as a teenager has to deal with this. Once you lose the innocence of childhood, people start not saying what they mean and meaning what they say, and you have to figure out your way to navigate it, and ultimately nobody can tell you how to do it but you. And then learning that once you do become 18, it's not over. You know, some people didn't quote unquote get through it successfully, and even the ones who did, you find out that, you know, what you understood of the world at 18 isn't complete. And there's even more complication and change on top of that, right? And so I think figuring that out, you know, how to get the love we want and give the love we want in the real world is something that's on almost everybody's mind.
Yeah, it's a little bit of a tangent, but I think something that really, because I think a lot about like, okay, like he has this theme of like, we want to be loved, but we hurt others and we hurt ourselves. You know, anybody could make a show about that, right? I think one thing that makes Anno and the rest of the Evangelion team's take on it so strong is there's a quote from Anno. We'll try to find a link to it in the description. But so it's not well known, but, well, it's known if you're a weeb, but Anno is a direct kind of apprentice, student, disciple of Hayao Miyazaki. So he worked on a lot of
stuff. The Apprentice Gone Rogue.
The Apprentice Gone Rogue, because those two fucking roast each other. But he has a great quote where I think it was just prior to Princess Mononoke, but I could be wrong, where he talks about he loves Ghibli movies and he loves Miyazaki's work, but he kind of gives him a criticism that there's no blood in his mentor's film. And he uses blood in kind of air quotes as a stand-in of like the messy, difficult, complicated parts of life. There's another quote for him where he talks about how he grew up with an abusive father who was also disabled, and kind of his interaction and exposure to disability gave him a understanding and a love of kind of broken people and broken things, and how he always fascinates over that more than things that are perfect and whole. And I think a lot of that really shines through, because any show that tells you, like, oh, you should love others even at the risk of being harmed yourself, like, you're like, yeah, whatever, fuck off. it can read very hollow, but I think there's something about the way that Anno does it and his willingness to kind of explore the messy parts, explore parts that are awkward and flawed and not great, that I think make that theme specifically stand really strong, and again, like, elevated above its predecessors, where it doesn't just feel like lip service. It doesn't just feel like, oh yeah, this is something he read on a fortune cookie and wants to share with us all.
Right. Because, I mean, depending on which ending you watch and how you interpret it, it's entirely possible that no one figured it out.
Yes.
By the end of this story. So there's a lot of failure, and people have to understand that in real life, because you do have a lot of failure in exploring this part of your life or trying to figure it out. Mm-hmm. So I agree. It's just having that darkness, but not like, what's the word I'm looking for? Not overt, cringy darkness, but the darkness of reality really brings the themes home, both the positive and the negative sides of them.
Yeah, it's not Warhammer Grimdark, but it definitely has a weight to it that other shows lack.
Another thing I'd love to get into, both from a lore and philosophy, oh my god, the heat is getting there. I'm keeping that in. A lore and philosophy perspective is the angels. It's probably one of the most interesting parts of the show, at least from like a lore science fiction perspective, and they really are, of course, part of the central story. They have as much impact on what happens and how characters change their relationships as conversations, maybe more.
Yeah, they keep the show from turning into just a Talking Heads West Wing type drama, essentially.
Right, eventually you're gonna go off and find an angel, even if it's eventually they're not so much giant monsters as, you know, Death Stars and ghosts and viruses and all that stuff. But yeah, I love how they gradually adapt to become more ruthless and effective in their goal of reaching the bottom of Nerve, the bad basement. And yet, simultaneously, they understand humanity better and better and offer them a way out.
Yeah, that's something that's always, that I really loved about the series, too, especially when I first saw it, is that there was this progression from, initially, the angels are, they're almost like forces of nature. Like, they're, you know, Ultraman villains or Godzilla monsters, where they show up, they wreck shit, and we gotta just figure out how to deal with them. They're problems that Nerve and Shinji must solve, and they become catalysts for growth and change or complexity as they go. Complexity initially. But I love how, like you said, as it goes, the attacks go from like physical threats to psychological threats. So you go from, here's a big monster, it's leveling the city, to here's a weird, scary shadow void that has swallowed Shinji, and yeah, he's gonna run out of air and suffocate, but the real scariness is like the isolation and loneliness. Or here's an angel that will corrupt and twist your body, but also really wants to understand humans. Here's an angel, and I think it's either before or after, the next one they send is like, here's an angel that will literally, like, shred your mind and, like, weaponize all of your issues against you, until finally right. You get to the last one where it's literally, this could easily be a person, if not for the fact that they're an angel with a mission to accomplish.
And yeah, it gets more and more personal. And less external, and yet remains exciting, which I think is really brilliant, because even when, you know, you have an angel who's literally just a light bulb sitting on the other side of the moon, you're invested in what's happening, because the impact that's having on Asuka's mind is so horrifying.
Oh man.
The editing and the artwork gives you such a visceral experience.
That episode is so rough. It's so good, but it's so rough.
So yeah, the angels all have their own way of trying to accomplish this goal of getting to what they think is Adam, but turns out to be Lilith. And then when they actually accomplish it, they suddenly turn around and say, like, well, Shinji, what do you want to do? Which is very fascinating and creepy.
Yes, that is a very, like, something I always found really fascinating. Like, Kaoru's a great character too. Like, he's only shows up for an episode, but, like, literally the LGBT anime fan base loves that boy and will protect that boy with their lives. But I do like that notion as well, where it's like, when he realizes that he's been had, he'd rather leave the choice up to Shinji, which is exceedingly cruel, but also kind of kind and merciful in a weird, warped way. And it just kind of goes back to that feeling of Eva being like, you know, almost a little bit of Hedgehog's Dilemma, where it's like, yeah, I love you, but also I'm going to hurt you really, 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 really badly.
Right. Do you want me to kill you and everybody you know? Or do you want to be the one to literally kill me, the person you opened up to more than anyone else in the world?
Your first love in every sense of the word.
Yeah.
And this is just one of many. There's so many Eva rabbit holes to go down. So many.
Absolutely. Like I said, just the taste. I doubt it. We never get this much feedback. But if there is an overwhelming desire for us to do another Ava episode...
Yeah, boy.
Maybe. nice Ainsley impression. Or Ainsley, however you pronounce it. Anyway, if you do want us to do that, send in your letters, kids. But for now, we're going to tie it on back to our homeboy, the big G, Godzilla. Part 3. Anno is a tokusatsu nerd.
He is the biggest nerd that there ever was. Oh my god.
Yes. If you don't know what tokusatsu is, basically, it's the Japanese words for special effects, or very close to it. And that covers a lot of different things, but specifically, think Godzilla, Ultraman, Kamen Rider, Power Rangers, whatever the fuck they're called in Japanese.
I think it's Sentai.
Sentai, right. And of course, this is the whole reason I thought I could get away with doing an Evangelion episode in the first place, is Hideaki Anno's connection to Godzilla. And Shinji Higuchi. I always tend to leave him out because he's less well-known, but he plays an equally big part in this story.
Yes, and has some direct ties to Godzilla and branch Godzilla fandom, as we'll get into.
Yes, absolutely. And this all kind of goes back to the fact that this man is a gigantic nerd for the stuff he grew up with in the 60s and the 70s. The classic Godzilla, Gamera, Ultraman, Kamen Rider, all that stuff. has mixed around in his brain and come out in the dark concoction that is Ava. It's basically if you threw a 200 level psychology textbook in a blender with a picture book of all the Godzilla movies, you'd get Ava.
And it's so one, it's fun just because the deeper you get into the tokusatsu side, like the more you can see Anno is just like painting his love all over the walls. There's, you know, shots that directly emulate, you know, the military fighting monsters in Godzilla and Ava. I don't know if there are any direct references, but any, except for the last few, any of the early Evangelion angels could easily be swapped out for an Ultraman villain or a, you know, Godzilla monster or a Zone Fighter monster. It's just, and again, the sense of weight, the sense of awe, like, I would not be surprised if they didn't use rubber suits at some point to help plan shots or scenes for Evangelion. But it's also funny because Anno is a giant nerd. He, spoiler alert, has worked on a Godzilla film, is making a Kamen Rider and a Ultraman film. Yeah, had some involvement with the behind the scenes for the Gamera movies that they made in the 90s. But if you look at the themes of Evangelion and some of his, like, solo live-action film works, he's such a big proponent of, like, hey, fantasy's cool, but you gotta live in reality. You gotta move beyond fantasy. And so I'm like, the guy who lived in a world of fiction and was obsessed with fiction makes a fiction about how fiction's really dope, but you gotta move on from fiction, and then proceeds to go make a bunch of live action movies about the fiction that he loved as a child.
It's very true. I have a feeling as a father, he's not the do as I do type. do as I say, not as I do. Because he's just living his fantasy, using his clout to get to make all his nerd dreams come true. Like you said, wrote and directed Shin Godzilla with Shinji Higuchi. Wrote Shin Ultraman, which Shinji Higuchi is directing. And the word is he's going to direct Shin Kamen Rider,
yep.
Whenever that comes out in a few years. So yeah, in every way, he's just gotten to live the dream. But even before this point, it was obvious. Like you said, he did the special features for the Gamera DVDs, which is crazy. Like, imagine, like, Steven Spielberg doing the Star Wars special features. That's kind of just what the level this
is. Just low-key shows up.
Right. And not only that, apparently tried to inject, like, fake drama into it because he thought it was boring. Which, of course, pissed off his friend Shinji Higuchi and was like, why did you do this? But yeah, curated an exhibit on special effects movies for the Museum of Contemporary Art in Tokyo. It's about as obvious as you can get.
The man loves monsters and has consistently loved monsters throughout his whole career, it seems like.
Right. And I had a separate section for this in our outline, but I think we're just sort of naturally rolling into it. So here we go. Part 4, Godzilla in relation to Evangelion. There are echoes of both the older tokusatsu in Ava,
mm-hmm.
and then echoes back from Ava into more recent tokusatsu. So really the big central pillar of this discussion is Shin Godzilla, because mm-hmm. that's his baby as much as Ava. And we've said Shinji Higuchi's name a bunch of times, but to connect him to Ava, he was also an important creative figure. Obviously not the big papa, but he was like one of the character designers and writers, if I'm not mistaken.
I believe so.
And they've been close for decades. So they together made Shin Godzilla, which we haven't covered yet. We'll see when I get to it. Spoiler, I like it a lot. And it was sort of my backdoor introduction to Eva. I think that's when you started trying to get me to watch it, is shortly after.
I was going to say, and it's funny because that was not the intended plan. But when I saw that movie and there were so many callbacks to Eva, like literal soundtracks ripped from Eva and surgically implanted in that movie, I was like, you gotta watch Eva. Like, there's no reason. Like, the guy who made that Godzilla movie you liked made this. Like, you gotta do it.
Right. And it only took me 4 years to finish. But you're right. Infamously, except for a couple of tracks, the Shin Godzilla soundtrack is pulled entirely, like one half Eva music, one half old Godzilla tracks. And some of the visual composition in Shin Godzilla is also directly pulling from Eva. I can't think of like how to describe it off the top of my head, but there is some stuff that's like shot for shot, like you're ripping your own shit, man.
There's also some story composition that I feel like is kind of taken as well, just in terms of like, you know, in the same way that Eva is more concerned about the teenage boy, like the actual teenage boy human in the pilot seat, as opposed to like the cool giant robot that other shows would be, Shin Godzilla almost is like, we're more concerned about the pencil pushers and the bureaucrats and like the people who have to put together the response to this crisis, compared to like, you could even go as late as like Godzilla 2014, where it's like, yeah, military heroes, fuck yeah, soldiers gonna go fight the monsters, and is entirely almost focused on them for 3/4 of the film. So you definitely, or there's just other little things like, you know, kind of in the hero of Shin Godzilla is a little bit more of a traditional hero, but he's still not the guy you would expect. He's an underdog. There's some political commentary in both. We don't really have time to get into it, but like, Eva is definitely made in a post-economic bust Japan, and it shows a lot.
Right.
And there's some cultural aspects that kind of hit as well. Shin Godzilla is very much a, like, critique of, hey, remember the Fukushima disaster? Yeah, you handled that real bad.
Yeah, if, I mean, whether you've seen it or not, I guess, Shin Godzilla is seen through the lens of bureaucracy, to the point that the first time I saw it, I was so thrown off for the first half hour of the movie. I'm like, oh, this is an interesting like way to introduce the conflict. And then like eventually I realized, like, wait, no, this is gonna be it. This is how they're going to show us the whole thing.
Meanwhile, I'm just sitting next to you laughing my ass off, because I'm like, this is literally just the bridge bunnies in Evangelion. Like, this is literally Nerve headquarters right now, but in a Godzilla film. And and that's the thing, it's a copy pasta that works. Like, right. It's a good movie. It doesn't, like, you could argue it feels derivative, but...
Right. Godzilla's been derivative off himself so yes. many times that being derivative off something else is interesting as a change of
plan. And that the transfusion went so smoothly, where you're like, yeah, this works perfectly fine.
So yeah, it's from the perspective of a bureaucrat who, I guess, yeah, to bring it back to what you said, he has a little more willpower than Shinji, but less power to make his own decisions. He's almost like a mirror image, where like he's a very strong and straightforward person from the perspective of a Japanese bureaucrat, mm-hmm. but whereas all the decisions are on Shinji and he hates it, he can't get anyone to listen to him, and he's perpetually frustrated by it.
Whereas in Shin Godzilla, this character, there's a very funny joke that someone pointed out to me, where throughout the film they show every character's name and their job description, so it gives their title, right. And as the film goes on, the main character of Shin Godzilla just keeps getting more and more and more titles. And it's actually, like, a great bit of black comedy that, like, they're trying to stop this monster from destroying Tokyo, and this guy just keeps getting promoted and more responsibility.
Yep. And, to tie it back to what you were saying about, you know, Anno brings the blood, mm-hmm. in a metaphorical sort of way, it's definitely a top competitor for most depressing Godzilla movie.
Yeah, I'd agree with that.
I think, put in its proper context, the original is still bleaker, but this takes a handy second place, in my opinion, because you get to very viscerally see the death toll, and Godzilla himself, normally you can at least look at Godzilla and think, like, ah, he's so cool. And I know what I'm about to say is something people hated about it, but I liked. This is a very different Godzilla. He looks very sick and wounded and unhappy. A thing that should not be a Lovecraftian take on Godzilla. And there's still enough slavish devotion to, like, the soul of Godzilla that it feels like him, but it's a very different thing physically and for the story.
He is literally, I remember hearing in an interview that he was designed after burn victims specifically, which, whoo, that strikes a nerve in a country that got hit with a nuke. And also just the idea, like, again, part of why I love the monsters in Eva is they truly feel alien, and I don't want to give away the stinger at the end of that movie, but, like, the kind of final shot of Shin Godzilla in that movie is just a great example of, like, oh, that's some wild shit that I've not seen many other Godzilla movies, like, capable of imagining or envisioning, or, like, able to handle with such, like, weight and dread. I think you know what I'm talking about.
Yes, and I think the audience does too. We're talking about the very end, and much like a lot of scenes in Ava,
mm-hmm.
left up to your interpretation exactly what it means, but whatever it means, it ain't good.
Nope.
We should talk about the reverse too, how Anno used elements of old tokusatsu in Ava.
Yes.
So you mentioned the time limit on the Ava battery, which is literally just pulled from Ultraman, mm-hmm. and Zone Fighter. All of them had... That was their one weakness, is like, oh, if we run out of time before we kill the big monster, it's over.
That comes back in the worst way in End of Evangelion. It hurts so much.
You get the most gruesome version of that.
Don't
at the end.
Change your batteries, y'all. Do not get caught running out of batteries in your Ava.
And there's some more minor subtle things, like there's always a bunch of shots of military forces setting up in every episode to be ineffectual and get blown up. Much like Godzilla, actually, but those are pulled from, like, almost shot for shot from old Showa movies, like all the tanks and trucks rolling up.
Something that hit me, too, because I feel dumb, but I just realized this. In a lot of Ultraman series, like, Ultraman is the titular hero, and he's always the one who has to solve the problem, but a lot of screen time and focus is dedicated to, like, whatever organization is behind either helping Ultraman or is, like, tangential to Ultraman's mission. And so, like, I think that's a carryover from tokusatsu as well, where it's like, there's a lot of Ultraman shows where it's like, we're gonna focus on the Guts crew and their cool aircrafts and all their cool science tech, meanwhile Ultraman is the one who always has to come in and solve the problem. And so that, I think, is an interesting carryover to Ava, where it's like, yeah, there's a lot of emphasis on, as I call them, the bridge bunnies, and them doing the techie shit that helps the Ava be able to fight or to be able to function properly.
Right. Which is something that was also in a lot of the 90s movies, but in a much less effective way. Because usually they didn't have any input into what was happening.
Yes.
And even when they did, it wasn't very effectively shown. I guess I'm tipping my hand to what I'm going to think of the Hezai movies, but don't lynch me early. I'll have some positive things to say too when we get
there. I have no love for those movies, and the one thing I will give Shin Godzilla fans can fight me, is at least that humanity can eke out a win and actually earn it.
Yep, absolutely. And this feels almost anticlimactic to end on, but to bring Shinji Higuchi back as well in those down years between Eva and this Shin series of movies. He worked with Shisuke Kaneko doing the special effects for the Gamera trilogy and for GMK, which is one of the best regarded Godzilla movies of the 21st century. And you definitely see the influence, because all of those show giant monster fights in a more visceral, frightening way. Mm-hmm. Like how in Gamera 1 you see the corpses of the people that the Gaios are chewing up.
Mm-hmm.
Or Gamera getting his hand ripped off in Gamera 3. Or spoiler if you haven't seen GMK, the drill from the little submarine burst. No, the drill from the missile bursting out of Godzilla's chest and making a big hole in it in GMK.
Or I can even think of, like, there's some minor callbacks to Eva. The third Gamera movie feels very much in the vein and under the influence of Eva, where it's like, you have a troubled teen. They're given control over a giant monster. It goes very, very bad. There's some weird, like, doomsday culty, you know, bad vibes, religious leader in there as well, so...
Yep. And I think we've covered it, except for one last little thing, which is just once in a Universal Studios Osaka attraction, Godzilla has fought Eva Unit 1. That's the ultimate Anno nerd mashup. Shin Godzilla versus Eva.
Yup, that shit is absolutely bonkers.
Which, if I'm not mistaken, that's not how the attraction opened. I think it was just a survive Shin Godzilla kind of thing. But, you know, at that point, how can you resist, right?
That the man cannot be stopped. He will get his nerd tendrils into everything, and there's nothing we can do.
So, this is showing yet another side of my geek obsessions, but I love sophisticated theme parks and theme design, and thinking about how that all works. And so, as somebody who's really into it, granted, I haven't been on it. I've only seen videos, but judging by the videos, I'm not that impressed with it. It doesn't look that great, but if you're gonna do something like this, you at least want it to be interesting. And I like how they use perspective in the attraction, at least. So you're inside Eva 1 for most of it, so you feel like you're coming face-to-face fighting Godzilla, which is something we haven't seen so much before.
Yeah, the CG's a little bit messy. There's definitely some kind of, like, you know, soaring over California vibes that kind of take away the danger. But it's still ambitious, if nothing else. And I feel like that's kind of the go-to for Anno, where it's like, Eva is a really good series. Eva is really, really messy. But Eva is nothing if not ambitious for what it did and was aiming to do. For just like a 90s scrappy cast.
Right.
Or sorry, crew of creators.
Yeah, I mean, I don't have the deep knowledge to get totally into the history of Eva, but, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe, you know, they were just had gotten some success. They finally picked up some money, and this was sort of like their big risk-taking move. Like, what are we going to do with this money? And they ended up making something that was both a big step forward for anime and hugely successful, luckily.
And also riddled with a lot of controversy and chaos is the only word I can give for it. Like,
absolutely.
We don't touch on it too much, and we're probably not going to, but, like, Ava is very beloved now, but for its, like, after the show finish, and especially after the movie, it was very controversial and a very, like, hot button, was it really good, was it not really good piece of media for its time in Japan.
Right. It was like The Last Jedi. A bunch of nerds were angry because it didn't go the way they hoped it would.
Anno got death threats, and then he put those death threat letters in End of Evangelion. Shit's wild, y'all.
Which I love. Yeah. He's a man who's not afraid to embrace the chaos, whether it's Eva or Godzilla or his statements to the press. What was the meme you shared with him and Miyazaki?
Oh, yes.
Let's end it on that.
Yes. So there's a lovely meme that I found just out and about. I think I literally Googled Anno Miyazaki. And it's Anno and Miyazaki sitting on a park bench. And it's in the style of the Drake meme. So, you know, happy face Anno. And then the second statement, it's kind of depressed, deflated Anno. And Miyazaki says to him, "I always felt that your greatest strength was making candid stories. Then you create Evangelion and end up not demonstrating that strength at all." Like I said, those two roast each other.
Oh, you gotta love it. Okay, everybody. As always, thanks for listening. If you have anything you want to say about this episode or just in general, send us an email, a tweet, YouTube comment. I've gotten better about checking all those and replying to them. We'd love to know what you think. Definitely share the show online or, you know, in person in conversation. That's how we're going to go on and conquer the world through our Godzilla evangelizing. We can only do it with your help.
And who knows, if we get enough feedback, maybe I'll come back and I can face my doppelganger over Godzilla Singular Point.
Right. Do you want to see the Matt Gregg face off? Send in your notes, kiddies. But thanks, as always, for being on, Matt. This was a blast.
No problem at all. I'm very, very happy that you had a good time. This would not be a fun episode if you didn't.
No. And honestly, this was more fun than all of Ava combined. Or, well, I shouldn't say more fun. More whimsical. So, if you haven't seen it, I urge you to take your depression pills and get through the series. It's a memorable experience. If you can get over the problematic stuff about it. And if you have seen it, let us know what you thought of this episode. And with that, keep spreading the word of Godzilla.
And Ava.
If you haven't yet, leave a nice comment or review wherever you like to listen. That would really help us out. That's it for this show, but we'll see you soon. In the meantime, keep spreading the word of Godzilla.